Kenneth Lickrecht. He is at Caltech. He's the chairman of the physics department there. He works on, apart from Crystal Group, he works on LIGO. Also, he's worked in the past on the sun, on the structure of the sun, and laser cooling. His CV has a long list of honors, but I think the single item that's most interesting is the Swedish Postal Service stamp. Took some of his photographs and used them on the stamps. And today he's going to tell us about the physics of snowflakes.
Okay, thank you. All right, so what I want to talk about is a phase transition today, a pretty simple phase transition. So I thought I'd start with the water phase diagram. And it's pretty complicated. Some of you know water has a lot of stable states, spread a lot of crystalline states at high pressure. But I want to remind everybody that when you look at a phase diagram, this is really a statics problem. These are all equilibrium states. And whereas a phase transition is a dynamical problem. And as you think all the way back to freshman physics, dynamical problems are harder than statics problems, but they can also be a lot richer. And in this case, I think it's a pretty interesting problem. We're going to be looking at one particular phase transition, not the whole diagram, just right here, from vapor to solid. Okay, so it's not obvious looking at the phase transition and just seeing a line there that this is the kind of thing that you would end up with when you take water vapor and turn it into ice. Okay, it's a pretty simple phase transition, and that's a single crystal. Okay, so there's nothing complicated there. But it's a very complex morphology. Now, some of you who've been around for a while may look at this and say, well, that's just diffusion-limited growth and branching. And we know that already. There's nothing new there. But I can tell you very quickly that's just part of the story, and there's a lot more interesting things going on. And so to see that, let's do a little experiment. Okay, a simple experiment. So we're going to grow some snowflakes in the lab. Okay, so we have a tank. This is maybe a meter high. And we got some cooling on there. So we cool it down to whatever temperature we want. We put some water in the tank and heat it up, and so water vapor evaporates, and it fills the tank, and so you get supersaturated air inside the tank. And then we need something to nucleate crystals. We take a little pulse of compressed gas, it expands very rapidly, gets very cold, and that nucleates crystals. And so they have ice crystals. They come up here and they just float around, they're very small, and they grow in the supersaturated air until they fall and they hit the substrate, and we've got a camera looking at that, and we see crystals hitting the substrate. Okay, so what we're going to do now is grow some crystals, and we're just going to change the temperature of the tank, mostly. Okay, and so that's the temperature of the air in which the crystals grow. This is all just in air. Okay, so here we're growing crystals at -2. Okay, and there's a lot of variety, the variations in the growth. That's just because the conditions in that tank are not very uniform, so we get lots of different crystals. But you can see overall, these are thin plates. Here's some seen edge on. But mostly just thin plate-like crystals. Okay, they don't get very big because they're not falling very far. Okay, so their growth time is a minute or two as they flip down through the air. Okay, so that's fine. That's at -2. If we cool the tank down a little bit at -5, now we get something different. These are hexagonal columns. So think wooden pencils. They have six sides and they're columns. And so it's very different morphology. Okay, just by changing the temperature a few degrees. Okay, now we go down a little colder, -15, and we see very large, very thin plates. Some are branched. Again, there's a lot of variation, but very, very large, very thin plates. Okay, and you can see there's a scale bar here. So there's something going on other than just diffusion-limited growth. And we do a lot of observations like this. We can put them all together into something that's called the snow crystal morphology diagram. So we have temperature down here and supersaturation or humidity on that axis. And we see a few things. First of all, if you grow crystals at low supersaturations, you get slow growth and simpler morphologies, so solid plates, solid prisms. And as you go higher in supersaturation, the growth is faster and it's also more complex. And that's understandable just from diffusion-limited growth again. Okay. But there are these transitions also as a function of temperature, where we go from plates to columns to plates and up here to columns again as a function of temperature. And it's an easy experiment, and it's been done, it was done a long time ago. It's first done in the 1930s by a Japanese Rooker here in Nakaya. And this transitions from plates to columns to plates to columns is still an unsolved problem. Okay. This line is the water saturation. That's the vapor pressure of water with respect to ice. And so that's what you might find in a dense cloud. Okay. But the interesting thing, I mean, the thing I like to emphasize is that it's not just that there's a few details missing. I mean, we don't even have a qualitative explanation for why these crystals grow, why these morphologies change so dramatically as a function of temperature. You know, it's just ice, and the stuff falls out of the sky. You'd think you'd have a better idea what's going on, but there it is. And that's the kind of thing I want to try to explain. Okay. So where do we start? Start at the beginning, square one. Where does snow come from? Because, you know, we can look at snow crystals in the lab. We can also look at them outside. It's a phenomenon that a lot of people can get their arms around. So here's snow on the ground. Where does it come from? We all know it comes from the clouds. What's going on in the clouds? Well, a cloud is a bunch of water droplets, okay? And as the cloud gets colder, the water droplets will supercool, and they'll start to freeze. When you get around minus 10 or something, they start to freeze. They've got little dust particles in them. And so one of them will freeze, say, and it starts to grow. It turns into an ice crystal. And it'll start to grow. It grows by accumulating or attracting water vapor from the air. And the water vapor comes from the water droplets, which evaporate. And so as this thing grows, the water droplets evaporate and the ice crystal grows until at some point it's so heavy that it just falls out of the clouds. And it takes roughly 100,000 water droplets to make one snowflake. Okay. So it's a funny way. It's a funny phase transition. Here we're going from liquid to solid, but we do it by way of the gas phase. So it seems a little more complicated than it needs to be, but that's the way it happens. Okay. So what's going on in the crystal? Again, very basics. We know the structure of the ice crystal. That's an easy one. And it's a hexagonal symmetry. Okay, so that's where the symmetry of the crystals come from. So how does that happen? Through a process of faceting. So if you have, say, a chunk of ice or a round crystal, the molecules from water vapor are hitting the crystal, and they don't stick as well, of course, to the facet surfaces because there's not so much bonding there. A lot more molecular bonds to be had at these nooks and crannies and the rough areas. And so if you let this crystal grow for a while, the rough spots fill in, and you're left with nothing but the slowest growing surfaces, and those are the facet surfaces. And so this faceting is how the geometry of the molecule, the crystal, is sort of transferred to the geometry of a large flake, a large crystal structure. Okay, and so we can grow little crystals in the lab and see the very basic hexagonal prism structure. Okay, so then we do come along to the diffusion limited growth, and there's an instability, a growth instability, sometimes called the Mullen-Sekerka instability. I like to call it the branching instability because it's more descriptive. But so we've got this little hexagon that formed because of faceting. Okay, and as it grows, water vapor is diffusing through the air. And so it diffuses more readily to the tips than it does to other parts of the crystal because the tips are sticking out farther. And so since the diffusion rate is higher, the tips of the hexagon will grow more quickly. And as they grow more quickly, they stick out farther. And as they stick out farther, they grow faster still. And that's positive feedback, which is where the instability comes from. So in short order, when this thing goes, the hexagon will just sprout branches, okay, because of this growth instability. And then as it gets bigger, you can see it can sprout side branches as well. And that's the whole business of diffusion-limited growth and how the structure arises, the side branching and the branching. And this is where most of the complexity of these crystals come from, is this process, okay? Again, if you look at just your average snowflake, you can sort of understand it nicely. You start with a water droplet, it freezes, it grows some facets into a hexagon, and then the thing starts to form branches. And then the crystal is moving around in the cloud, and as it moves, each time the temperature changes or the humidity, the growth changes on the arms, because the growth is very sensitive. We saw from the morphology diagram that a few degrees temperature change will change the way the crystal grows. So this thing will start growing plates on the arms or more branches or what have you. And so eventually you get a big snowflake. And so it has a complex history because it had a complex path through the clouds. Okay, the temperature and humidity it saw as a function of time with some complicated function, and that gives a complex shape for the branch. Each branch experiences the same history because they're all traveling together, so they grow in synchrony, and so you get the symmetrical crystal. And of course, no two paths are exactly the same. These crystals are falling through a chaotic environment, and so you sort of have no two snowflakes that are alike. Okay. So there you go, that's your basic snowflake. And so if you look at one of these things, you can sort of see all the features. There's the little remnant of the original hexagonal form. It's even smaller, there's more structure in there. You see the branching that came from the tips. And then there are these side branching events that happened on all six branches at the same time. And you can see it's the branch. This branch is parallel to these others because it's all just one single crystal. Okay, so there you go. Basic understanding of a snowflake. It's great, except it doesn't tell us anything about the morphology diagram. So it's not just diffusion-limited growth, and it's not just faceting. There's more going on. Okay, so now what do we do? Well, we can look to other fields for a little inspiration. There's lots of crystals that grow in the world, in particular lots of mineral crystals. You can dig these things out of the ground. There's thousands of different minerals that have been cataloged. Geologists like to do this, and they apply X-ray crystallography and get the chemical makeup of these crystals and where all the atoms sit. But again, crystallography is a statics problem. Okay, you're just wanting to know where the atoms sit. And that gives you the symmetry of the crystal, but it doesn't tell you anything about the morphologies. That's a dynamics problem again. Okay, so a lot of crystals have really, you know, wacky morphologies, and that gets us back to the dynamics of the crystal growth. And if you start reading about this, you find that nobody really knows any of this stuff. You dig these things out of the ground, and they're cataloged. Sometimes the morphologies of a lot of them are cataloged, but people don't really understand this. The morphologies and the growth rates. I mean, if you want to get quantitative, you got to look at growth rates also. And these are not things that are easily calculated. Okay, we don't have a good understanding of how this stuff works. And that's the molecular dynamics of the crystal growth. So you may be thinking, why not just use molecular dynamics simulations? We have a lot of good chemical tools. It turns out that didn't work very well because there's just a huge range of times and spatial distances. For example, the molecular motions happen on picoseconds. And so when you're doing a molecular dynamic simulation, you're sort of working in picoseconds. But the growth rates for these crystals are really, really slow. They can be seconds or hours or years for mineral crystals. So that doesn't really work, not very well. So we're stuck. We don't really understand all this. So what about sort of industrial crystals? What about silicon? Surely we know this one up one side and down the other. And you'd be surprised. There was a lot of work in the 50s to try and understand this. But just when people were sort of getting into the physics of crystal growth, the engineers came along and found recipes for growing big crystals. And nobody cared anymore about the physics. Everybody just jumped on to the recipes. And you know, and it's sort of true to this day. A lot of the work in the 50s was really very good. And it's sort of quit around 1960. There's still work, but it's not quite the same intensity it was in the early days. And part of it, there's this sort of sociological barrier. When you're doing things like crystal growth, you're really doing material science. And material science is not a branch of physics. Material science is a branch of engineering. You go to any university, you'll find the material science department is in the engineering department. And engineers, they care about the final products. They don't really care that much about the dynamics of crystal growth. They don't really want, they want to get rid of all that. They want a nice, single, perfect crystal. They don't care what they just don't want to think about the morphology. They really just want a desired final product. And if you can find a recipe that does it, that's good enough. And a lot of these things are trial and error. Some of these experiments nowadays, you can massively parallel things where you're growing zillions of different protein crystals in different conditions using different buffers, and you have no idea what's going on. You just hope for the best, and you pick the one that works the best, and there you go. So again, if you look at morphologies or growth rates, people don't understand these very well. And this is kind of how I got started in all this. I was just sort of poking around and thinking about these things, and I was kind of surprised at how little was known about the molecular dynamics of how crystals grow and how these morphologies arise. And I sort of noticed there's this sociological barrier that people just didn't want to study it. And so it looked like there was some interesting physics that was not getting done. And so I thought I'd look at it a little more closely. And so as I started thinking about this, it's like, well, you know, it's hard. There's a lot of different crystals. Each of the crystals acts a little differently. It's like condensed matter physics in general. There's not a lot of generalizations to be made, a lot of specific things. So I said, well, you really need the hydrogen atom, crystal growth, you know, something that's easy and simple enough. And so we'll solve that first, and then we'll worry about the general problem. So where do we get a hydrogen atom? Well, I started thinking about it, and it's like, oh, ice, that's perfect. Okay, it's not exactly a hydrogen atom. It's a little too complicated, but why ice? Well, it's a wonderful, it's monomolecular. There's one molecule. We don't have to worry about individual atoms. They don't count. The molecules don't lose their identity. So single molecule, and not only a single molecule, but a really well-known molecule. We know everything about water. You can grow this from vapor, which is great because we can grow as a function of temperature. And we can use a lot of tools from statistical mechanics. We know how vapor works. Very rich phenomenology, including the morphology diagram. I love the experiment. I'm an experimentalist, and these two are really, really important for me. I love the no safety issues. I've grown other crystals as well, looking for interesting systems. Oh, it's awful. I mean, you get these things, and the safety problems are just all the regulations you have to deal with. But not water. You pour it down the drain when you're done. You can't pour anything down the drain anymore. So, this sort of seemed like a simple problem. You know, and also it's just like this stuff falls out of the sky. How can we not understand this? You know, it's an embarrassment to the physics community. So really, it all comes down to the molecular dynamics of crystal growth. So I started reading about it, and it's really fascinating. And when you start reading the literature, there's a lot of neat puzzles, and it's not very well studied. It's really not well studied. I mean, I was reading papers that are 30 years old, 50 years old, because people just don't work on this. And, you know, it's hard to find a topic that people don't work on. There's a lot of scientists in the world. So why is this? Why is this so poorly studied? And again, there's this sociological barrier. It's really big. I mean, again, it's material science, but now there's no applications. You can't apply this to anything. It's just an interesting physics problem. And not only that, but it's the physics of snowflakes. You know? People just look at you like, what is this, high school physics project or something? I mean, this is nuts. But no, it's really complicated physics. It's just sort of disguised as something that seems simple. But there's an enormous sociological barrier to studying this. And so it hasn't been studied very well, which to me is just, that's an opportunity. You know, you've got a neat field that nobody's really doing anything in. But there's a problem. No funding, nothing. I mean, you ask your funding agency for money to study snowflakes, you know, they just look at you like, what are you, nuts? I mean, can you imagine if some government politician found out you were, getting a national grant to do this? I mean, heads would roll. So there's no money at all. I mean, zero. So what do you do? I mean, it was obvious that you couldn't just think about this problem. You need to do experiments. And I'm an experimentalist. I wanted to do experiments, but so I had to solve this problem first. And so I found a rather unorthodox solution in the way of snowflake photography, believe it or not. So, I'm reading about snowflakes and ice crystal growth and the history. And so when you're reading about this, you're looking at pictures because people like to take pictures. And it sort of comes along with it. And you run into this guy, Wilson Bentley. He was a Vermont farmer who lived from, in the 19th century and part of the 20th century. And he was the first person to start taking photographs of snowflakes. They took thousands of pictures of snowflakes. You can still buy his book. You go to Amazon, it's still in print. After a long time, it was published in 1931, the year he died. And as you look around, you find that there aren't any other pictures. These are the standard pictures. And I mean, these pictures were taken 100 years ago. And this is great. That's a great picture for 1890. But it's a lousy picture by modern standards. And so, how come nobody's done better than this? It just shocked me. And so again, this is kind of opportunity knocking. It was sort of opportunity pounding the door down. It's like, here's something that nobody's done in a long time and for no reason. So I got into the snowflake photography business. Sort of a hobby within this already scientific hobby. It became this artistic hobby. So I built a microscope. Nothing fancy. It's just some camera and some microscope objectives and some lighting. It's specially built for this project because snowflakes are about the wrong size. They're a little too small for normal macro photography. They're a little too big for normal microscope photography. And so you sort of want to build your own microscope. And you want to go places where it's cold. I live in Pasadena, so not a lot of snowflakes to photograph there. But that's okay. I just go places. And you know, since I have the morphology diagram in my hand, I know the best places to go. For instance, I know I want minus 15 C. So Waterloo's not cold enough. My favorite spot's up in northern Ontario, a little town called Cochrane, where it's cold. And I've been to Alaska and some other states and northern Sweden and various places looking at snowflakes. It's really a wonderfully fun thing to do if you don't mind cold. I grew up in cold country, so how do you do it? So here's you can't just pick up snow off the ground. That stuff looks terrible because it changes as it sits on the ground, and they become little ice cubes once they sit on the ground. You got to get them as they're growing, best or right after they've grown. So you set out, you wait till it snows, and you set out a piece of cardboard, and here's what it looks like. There's some snowflakes on there, and you get kind of good at saying, well, there's a nice one. I'll pick that one up. I got a little paintbrush, and you sort of carefully pick it up, and you put it on a microscope slide and stick it under the microscope, and take a picture of it, and there you go. A beautiful snowflake. Repeat as necessary. I've taken like 10,000 pictures, so. It's a lot of fun, actually, because they're all different. And I don't know how many of these I put in. Here's some. Got that one in northern Sweden, the big one. Weird looking things. Another nice one. You know, they fall out of the sky. It's kind of remarkable. And so now there's a nice looking snowflake. I have to point out they don't all look like this. Just, you know, full disclosure here. This is normally what you see. Okay. If you go out the next time it snows, there's about a 95% chance that it'll look like this. This is the kind of snow you get when it's warm and sticky and lots of, and the snowfall is kind of heavy because then you get a lot of crystals and they collide and stick and they all interfere with one another's growth. And so you just get a mess. So I spent a lot of time looking at this and going, well, I'm not going to go outside and look at that. So you got to spend a lot of time out there and eventually you see some nice ones like this if it's cold enough. Okay, so people often ask, you know, where'd the color come from? You know, why aren't snowflakes white? The snowflakes aren't white, they're clear. They're made of ice, so it's clear. And so I have a system where I have a color filter down here, and there's a field lens, so the filter is at a pupil. And so I'm putting light on the snowflake from different angles. If you don't use any filter, you'd sort of get a kind of bland thing. You can't see much. This is all the same crystal, of course. Then you use a filter like this. It's like putting blue light in from one side and red light in from the other. And it gives you some colorful highlights. And if you put some shading on one side, then it gives you more highlights. And it gives you sort of a three-dimensional depth. So Bentley did a lot of that. And this is my contribution to snowflake photography, is making colors and making more depth. And sometimes I use crazy colors. So here's some more pictures, just a few I throw in. Again, you know, people see this, they say, you must be using polarized light or something. No, there's no polarized light. It's just, you know, I'm putting all different colors in from different angles. And the snowflake acts like kind of a complex lens, and it just refracts the colors in different directions. And so no polarized light, and it's not colorized, it just comes out that way. So a lot of crazy colors, Christmas colors, whatever you like. So you got all these, what do you do with them? You start, you know, writing books, and you know, it's customary to thank your funding agency. Well, this is my funding agency, all the people who bought my books. I didn't really start out wanting to publish a lot of snowflake books, but I did one. It was sort of a popular science book, and you know, it was on my bucket list to write a popular science book someday before I kick it. And it was popular, and so, you know, once you write a book and it's popular, then your publisher is always all over you to write more books because, you know, they're making money. So I ended up writing, you know, the science book and a photographic book and a little gift book and a field guide and a kid's book. It's been just a lot of fun. So not only does this sort of fund all the research, but it put my kids through college too. So And it's kind of fun, you know, here I got to go on Martha Stewart, and Martha Stewart telling people to buy my books. That didn't hurt sales. So. I do a lot of magazine stuff. People, you know, they see my website and they want pictures, and so I've been on lots of magazine covers. There were the stamps. These are U.S. stamps. I got a call from the post office one day. It's like they wanted to make snowflake stamps. I actually predicted that. Why? Because the post office wants Christmassy stamps, because they like Christmassy stamps. But they don't like to promote any religion, right? Because we separate religious state and religion. So you want a Christmassy stamp that's not religious. Well, that's a snowflake. So I knew they'd come calling, and they did a few years ago. And they sold 3 billion of those. So that was kind of fun. And yeah, last year the Swedes got in. I was up in Sweden photographing snowflakes, and they put them on some stamps too. So I've sort of got stamp artist on my resume, which is an unusual thing. So and there's a website at the center of all this, snowcrystals.com, which shows lots of pictures. It's fun, you know. Everybody, a lot of people see snow, and it's a subject that, you know, people can get their arms around. You know, it's not quantum Hall effect. It's easier to understand. So anyway. Once you get all these pictures, you can start seeing all these things. They just fall out of the sky. So I'll give you a little tour. Like the columns, there's the cartoon. They often have hollows. So hollow column, that's diffusion limited growth again. The edges grow more quickly. Okay. Sometimes they close up. When the columns get longer, they start to branch out. That's branching. When you have a columnar crystal, that's diffusion limited branching there. Gives you needles. These are like 2 or 3 millimeters long. You don't notice them much. They look like little bits of hair on your sleeve. A little hard to see. Sometimes you get the snowfall. It's just nothing but columns, needles. So this is just, you know, I put out microscope slides and just that's all there was that day. Capped columns, one of my favorite kinds. There's starts out growing as a column, and then temperature changes, and it grows like a plate. So you get two plates on the ends of a column. They're like two wheels on an axle. Here's one I photographed, and then I sort of put it on end. Photographed, you put this one end in focus and the other end in focus. Sort of blurry thing is the other one in front. And so you see it's just two snowflakes on an axle. There's another one. You know, you can see these if you go outside, even in Waterloo. It helps if you have a little magnifying glass. But next time it snows, these are fairly common. Here's a kind of cool one. Very, very thin plates on the end. I've seen edge on. Here's one that really strange. It was a column and a plate. The plate got thick and then formed two little plates. So there's actually quite a layered structure, very, very thin plates. Those have about a 1 micron radius of curvature. So that's about as sharp as a razor blade. So triangular crystals. I wrote a paper about triangular crystals once too, and there's sort of an aerodynamic effect. So there's some triangle. You know, who knew? Crazy things. 12 branch crystals are all also out there. They're fairly easy to see if you go looking for them. There's a whole menagerie of different crystal types. So I wrote a book about that too, A Field Guide to Snowflakes. And it just talks about all the things you can see if you just go outside with a magnifying glass. It's kind of fun, actually. I mean, people think you're a real nerd, but it is kind of fun. But it does kind of bring you back to the physics. I mean, you see all these things falling out of the sky, and what's going on? I mean, why? Is there such a diversity of shapes, and you know, where do they come from in the first place? And you know, just what's the underlying physics? What's going on? So let's talk about. Let's go back to the beginning again. Talk again about the essential physics, and we saw these things. So we got the crystalline structure. Okay, that's known. They're dislocations. We don't have to worry about that most of the time, because these are pretty nice crystals. They don't have a lot of dislocations. Particle transport, the water diffuses through the air. That's a big player. We got tools from statistical mechanics. That's part of the physics that goes in, just the gas around the crystal. Attachment kinetics, okay, that's where the rubber hits the road. This is really the surface molecular dynamics. So the molecules hit the surface, and either they stick or they don't. And that's called attachment kinetics in the business. And that's a big deal, too. So it's usually attachment kinetics and particle transport are the big things. There are a lot of things that don't matter so much, but some people think they should, but they don't. Surface tension effects are negligible. We generate heat from latent heat because we're growing a crystal, but the heat transport is faster than particle transport, so we can usually ignore that. Aerodynamics, so it's important for, that's how you make triangular crystals, but it's otherwise really not very important. Surface chemistry. If there's any surface, any impurities in the system, air is an inert impurity, but you can also add chemicals, put chemical vapors in the air, for example, and that'll affect the crystal growth a lot. This is a really fascinating field, which is just, you know, you can have chemicals, catalysts that change molecular rates. You can also have catalysts that change crystal growth rates. Okay, same principle. It's just a catalyst. And of course, the world, there's a whole chemical, a whole list of chemicals that will affect the crystal growth. And there's a really, not just ice, all crystals. And it's just a fascinating field of how surface chemistry catalyzes crystal growth, which is almost untouched. It's just really, really interesting stuff. There are a little bit. People do use, for instance, surface chemistry to grow artificial diamonds because it's necessary. Some other crystals as well, but mostly this is very, very unstudied. It's kind of neat. But we're going to ignore it for now because we're just going to get rid of the impurities and just have a clean environment. So air is inert, and we just put water vapor in the air. So all these things that are important, we know real well, easily, except for attachment kinetics. That's the tough one. Okay, so let's see, what's attachment kinetics? Okay.
What about electric charge?
You know, if you put charge on the crystal, that'll also change the growth rates. You need a lot of charge. One of the fun experiments we do is we have crystals growing on a wire, and we put 2,000 volts on the wire, and we get these needles growing out. I forgot to mention, but we're going to ignore that too.
Okay. In natural conditions,
the charge is so small that it doesn't do anything. Nothing appreciable anyway. Okay, attachment kinetics. So what's going on? Well, we got a crystal. It's got a surface, and the water molecules are hitting the surface from the vapor, and then they have to attach, and the crystal grows. So they form terraces, and these things move. So what's going on? All right, we've got molecules hitting the surface. We can calculate that. That's simple statistical mechanics. There's some initial probability that they will stick. They will stick, and they will stay for a while. They don't stay forever. If they're floating around here on a facet surface, they'll pop off due to thermal motion. So there's a resonance time. They diffuse around. And they have to diffuse from here to someplace they can stick. And if they do that quickly enough, then it'll grow faster. They have to attach to this edge of this terrace. So there's some dynamics involved there. These edges don't just pop out of nowhere. We've got to make those. So we have to nucleate two-dimensional islands. So you make a little island. That's where the edge comes from. That's a nucleation problem. And then all of this, there's evaporation going on at the same time because ice has a very high vapor pressure. And so a lot of stuff going on. On top of that, surface structure. Ice doesn't look anything like that. Here's what the ice surface usually looks like. When you get close to the freezing point, maybe within 10 degrees of the freezing point, the top layer of molecules, they start to look more liquid-like because they're not attached so well. In the bulk, you've got neighbors on all sides. At the edge, you've only got neighbors on half the sides, and so they're not attached as well. And so they start to shake off. And so the ice surface actually has what's called a quasi-liquid layer on top. And the thickness of that layer diverges as you get close to the melting point. Okay, so there's a whole surface structure issue. Okay, and I mean, this is a mess. I mean, look at all this stuff. We don't know any of these things, right? You can't calculate any of that stuff. So it looks kind of hopeless, but it's not. So let's we'll define something that may or may not make any sense, but we'll see that it does. And that's what's called an attachment coefficient, alpha. And that's just the sticking probability. So we're going to say a molecule hits the surface, either it sticks or it doesn't, and that's the probability that it sticks. And we define that. There's the normal growth is just alpha times basically the number of molecules that hit the surface versus the number of molecules that evaporate off, because they're always evaporating off also. So that's a supersaturation. If the system is in equilibrium, then the vapor pressure on the outside of the crystal is just equal to the equilibrium vapor pressure, then the supersaturation is zero, and so it doesn't grow. And so that's just, you take the humidity and subtract 100%, and that's what the supersaturation is. And that's in the air above the crystal. And this is just statistical mechanics, easy calculation. So if you have a water droplet, doesn't have any of these issues. Alpha's one. Molecule that hits the water droplet sticks, and that's all there is to that. And so you can calculate the growth of a water droplet. But for a solid surface, alpha depends on all this stuff. And so So it's not necessarily obvious that defining this is going to make is going to help the situation, and it just sort of hides all the physics into one parameter. Okay, so but we'll do that. Okay, so you can see when you look at a snowflake, you can see what's going on. Well, it's a flat plate, so that tells you that the basal alpha is very small, so the growth rate is very low in the basal direction because that's a flat plate. It doesn't grow up or down; it grows out. Okay, so it's a flat plate. Alpha is much less than 1, which means you've got strong faceting. The facets here are this facet. And slow growth, and its kinetics limited growth. The prism facet, on the other hand, that's out here. Well, that's close to 1. When the growth is that fast, there's very little faceting because the facet surface is no different than any other surface. And so now it turns into diffusion limited growth, and you get a lot of branching. So you can kind of see, you know, alpha is doing something for you. But really, you need experiments to do anything with this. You can think about this all day, and you just don't get anywhere. And mainly, we want to measure the facet surfaces. Okay, so let's do another experiment. A little harder this time, but not too bad. So we have our same tank as we had before. We grow the little crystals, and they're floating around in here. Now we have a second chamber. That's where all the real physics goes on. We've got a substrate, and we drop these crystals kind of randomly on the substrate, and then we move the substrate around and position one of those crystals underneath the micro, above the microscope, and in a little experimental chamber, because the nucleation problem is kind of hard. We can't just make a crystal where we want it, because there's no reason for it to form there. So we take a bunch of these little guys and just drop them on the surface randomly, and then pick one out. Now here's what we're trying to achieve. We do achieve. Is we have a little box. Essentially, this is all a little box right here. That's the whole point of this whole thing, is to make that little box. Where we have some ice up here, that's the ice reservoir. Then we put our test crystal down below, and there's temperature. These are controlled. So if this is warmer than this, then the ice will evaporate from here and deposit on the test crystal. And then we can just measure the growth rate. So that's how we control the supersaturation. And we can either have air in there or whatever pressure we want. And we measure the growth. We can use some fun interferometer. We actually have a substrate in the ice crystal, and we put light in, and it bounces off this interface and that interface, and those two reflections interfere. And so we get something like this. You can see sort of here there's a little outline of a hexagonal plate. Then we have this light shining on it. It doesn't heat anything. It's really very faint. The light reflects off these two interfaces, and then we disperse it. And so we get fringes. Okay, that's the interferometer part. And by the spacing of the fringes, we know the thickness. And so now we do this over and over again. We can change the supersaturation, we can change the temperature, and we can measure out the growth rate. So we can do this under vacuum, and all this stuff's very sensitive. We grow lots of crystals, and what do we see? Oh, here's the experiment. They don't fall out of the sky anymore, so it's a little more complicated. You know, plumbing and stuff like that. Stuff that theorists don't really care about, so we'll move on. So what happens? Here's alpha, and here's the supersaturation. Now alpha here is just defined. We measure the normal velocity of the growth, and here's this kinetic stuff, the statistical mechanics is just wrapped up in there, and we know the supersaturation. So we just divide these and get alpha. And if we grow the crystal in air, then this effective alpha does this. It's just a diffusion limited alpha. And if we take the air away, then we get a much faster growth. That's kinetics limited. So since we don't care about the diffusion limited stuff because we know that already, we're interested in the kinetics. And so we usually run it a couple hundredths of an atmosphere. Okay. And here's what this functional form is, just this. Okay. A is usually 1. So alpha goes to 1 as the supersaturation gets very high, which is sort of what makes physical sense. And this functional form just comes from 2D nucleation theory. It's classical nucleation theory. So that's great. I mean, it fits this functional form very nice, which tells you that the attachment kinetics, which had all that nonsense on it, really is just limited by 2D nucleation of these islands. Okay. And there's only one parameter that matters. That's the sigma zero. And that's determined by the step energy. That's the energy of this step. That's the energy per unit length. Right, you have surface energy, which is energy per unit area. This is the step energy, energy per unit length. And so sigma just comes out of that from theory. And so we can measure sigma zero. here's sigma zero, here's the functional form, there's sigma zero is just around whatever it is. Here's sigma zero in percent versus temperature. This is minus one, minus 10, so it's cold is over here. And we get some curve, okay? So what? Well, it's complicated, it's got stuff. And here's how we're interpreting this now, is that low temperature, well then we've got ice, there's no surface melting. This is all because the surface melting interacts with everything. So at low temperature, no surface melting. The structure of ice just looks like a simple classical crystal. And the nucleation barrier is high because the step edge is high, the step edge energy is high. And it goes down just because the surface gets softer as you get it warmer. It's the best way to explain it. And so the energy of a step is sort of smeared out. The energy goes down as you heat the crystal up. Okay, but at some point, you get surface melting. This little bump is actually a real thing. I don't know what that bump is. It's the onset of surface melting. And when you have surface melting, then there's no more nucleation barrier because it's just the surface is amorphous. And so you'd expect the nucleation barrier to just drop down, and it does, a little faster than it was going down before. It drops down to a very low value. And so this is the nucleation barrier. But then it goes back up again. What's going on there? Well, now we're in fully developed surface melting. So we have a real kind of well-defined quasi-liquid layer on top. And there's no nucleation barrier here, but there is here. There's a water to ice nucleation facet, and there's a water to ice nucleation barrier. So it actually goes back up again. And so we kind of have a phenomenological view of what's going on. You can't call it a real theory, but we're getting there. This is just the basal facet. The prism facet does something different because it has a different structure. One of the nice things is we've reduced this dynamical problem of crystal growth down to just calculating the step energy. And the step energy is now a static number. It's a static quantity. So we've reduced a dynamical problem to a statics problem. And that's real progress because, statics problems you can almost solve. So maybe using molecular dynamic simulations in the future, this is new stuff, so we haven't had a chance to do anything, but maybe you could actually calculate this as a function of temperature on these surfaces, and then you really would say you understood something. So we're getting there. We're making headway. But so far, say we just know alpha empirically. Let's not worry about calculating the step energy. Let's just say we know it. Okay. Then we know the boundary conditions. So we can solve the differential equation, the diffusion equation, because we know the boundary conditions. So let's look at that for a minute. So what do? We make a numerical model. So you start with a seed crystal. You solve the diffusion equation. And then you sort of let the crystal grow a little bit. And then you solve the diffusion equation again. And then you repeat and watch the crystal grow. And there are various ways of doing this. There's a lot of literature on this. A lot of work was done in the 80s. There's different techniques, computational techniques. But mostly, they're just kind of diffusion equation solvers. You see there's an adaptive grid and all that kind of stuff. These work great as long as you don't have any faceting. Weak anisotropy, that's when these things work great. But that's not the system we got, because if you look at, say, alpha as a function of angle from the facet surface, this is just a cartoon, but alpha's high when you have a rough surface. But right at the facet surface, alpha just drops to very low numbers, especially at low supersaturations. So there's a huge cusp, and it's not rounded. It's a real cusp. If you look at it, it's absolute sine theta is what the functional form is there. And these programs do not like cusps. They just kind of don't work. I don't know why. They just don't seem to work. People haven't studied this enough to know exactly why they don't work, but they don't. Fortunately, there's a solution, cellular automata. It's a new technique that sort of came around in the last few years, and that works great. These other techniques don't work. Can't use them. Okay, these sort of diffusion equation solvers don't work. But cellular automata works great. So what do? Set up a grid. You got air pixels and ice pixels. Then you have nearest neighbor rules. So you can solve the diffusion equation by using nearest neighbor rules. You can talk about changing these pixels and accumulating mass and turning those pixels into ice, all using nearest neighbor rules. It's very easy to code. It works great for strong anisotropy. In fact, the cusps are built in. This would work terribly for weak anisotropy, but it works great because the cusps are already in there. You can't get rid of them. And so the first time this is really applied to the snowflake was In 2006, a couple of mathematicians, David Griffith and Yonko Grabner, that was the first time anybody had actually solved the diffusion equation to produce something that looked like a snowflake. So that was kind of neat. You'd think people have been doing this on the computer forever, but no, only since 2006. You can actually grow a hexagonal crystal on a rectangular grid if you do a little transformation. That's kind of a fun little point. So here's a crystal growing in the lab. There's one that's grown on the computer. At least they look similar. We're not talking quantitative stuff yet. Here's some more. So you can get what you get from these things is you can make growth patterns, crystals, on the computer that are both branched and faceted. So you've got facet and branched. And nobody had ever been able to do that before. Everybody was always working on branched crystals that were not faceted, because that's what works for metals and some things like that. When there's weak anisotropy, growth from liquid usually get weak anisotropy, but growth from vapor gets strong anisotropy. And so now we have the tools. Here's a fun one that was just somebody took one of their three-dimensional crystals and rendered it. I think it took more computer time to do the rendering than the actual growth. But anyway, you can do this. The problem is these guys are still not putting in the right physics. All physics is all wrong. But some of these structures are nevertheless fairly robust. These the branching and faceting, some of these ridges, these things seem to be fairly robust. So we're getting there, but we still need the right physics. Okay, the physics is still missing because this program did not use the data I showed you before because that didn't exist. This was just something they pulled out of a hat and it was wrong. I mean, it didn't show it's wrong, but it has some features which are right. They certainly solved the diffusion equation out here correctly. It's just the boundary conditions weren't right. So let's take our data and let's plug it in. Do we get a snowflake? No, it doesn't work because we're still missing some physics. This is brand new stuff. So I'll show you the new physics. It's another instability, a growth instability. So we'll start with our little experiment here. And we'll put a little prism. And we'll do it in air this time. We'll let it grow in air. And as the prism grows, a little plate develops on top of the prism. Here's a side view. It comes from one of these computer models. So you start it out with a little hexagonal prism. And as it grows, this plate starts to grow on top. So I showed you the capped columns. This is a half a capped column, so it's not too surprising. But what's fun is when you get quantitative, you start measuring the velocities. And you find is that the thing will grow. And when the plate forms, the outward velocity just takes off. It's much faster. It stays faster, even if you lower the supersaturation. So there's this hysteresis behavior that the plate grows very fast as long as it's a plate. But it didn't grow fast before it was a plate. So what's going on? So what's happening is what I call structure-dependent attachment kinetics. So the attachment kinetics is one thing on a faceted surface. It's very different when you have a very small faceted surface. So this thing right here, this edge, if you look at it, it's a facet. That's a facet. That's the edge. But it's a really narrow facet. It might be 100 molecules wide. And because it's a very small radius of curvature. And it turns out the nucleation barrier just is much lower on a thin facet than it is on a big facet. So you get this edge-enhancing growth instability. So this thing is like a block, and it starts growing, and it gets a little sharper. It's a little sharper, the nucleation barrier goes down, so it grows faster still, it gets sharper, and then the nucleation barrier goes down, it gets sharper again. And so it's a real instability. It's got positive feedback. And you end up with very, very thin plates because you've lowered the nucleation barrier on this very sharp edge. I don't know why. This is just data. There's a theory in there waiting to come out, though. I know that, because this is not something complicated. It's really a kind of an interesting phenomenon. But it's a big player in the morphology diagram because it explains, first of all, why crystals are so darn thin and flat. If you start to get quantitative in making these models, it doesn't really make sense that they would be that thin with that small an edge, unless you've got this instability. Not only that, but it also explains why you have these enormous transitions. Like if you look at the ratio of the growth rates of the facets here to here, changes by 100,000 in just a few degrees. And that doesn't make any sense from the physics of the just the normal growth rates, so the sort of surface stuff going on, unless you have this instability. So what happens is here, the instability sort of tips over to where it happens on the prism facet. Whereas here, it sort of tips a little bit the other way, and it happens on the prism facet, or the basal facet, rather. And it depends on which way it goes first. If it tips over there, then you get a big thin plate. If it tips over here, then you get a hollow column with a very thin edge. Okay, so it really just depends on exactly where that instability sits. The instability exists on both facets, but here it's a little stronger on one edge, and here it's a little stronger on the other edge, and here it goes back again. So again, we've kind of reduced the problem to now we just have to, instead of these enormous changes, it's just what's happening with that instability. So we're getting there. We haven't really got it all done yet, you know, it's still a work in progress. But I think this is the last really big piece of the puzzle. And now it's a matter of taking more data and trying to prove some of this stuff really works. So let me end with a fun story, because I was working on this, taking this data, and we started growing these in the lab, and I got a call from the BBC. It's like, well, they're making a documentary, Frozen Planet, and it's just going to be the biggest, best thing ever. And they wanted movies of growing snowflakes. And I said, well, you know, nobody's ever made a decent movie of a growing snowflake. I mean, people have made low-resolution, lousy movies. I've done that. But nobody's made a good movie. I mean, a really high-resolution movie. And they said, well, you know, this is going on HDTV. It's got to be beautiful. And I said, well, you know, I think I know how to do it for a small fee. And so they gave me some money, and I started making, you know, got into the movie business. So I'll show you some movies. This is fun. All right, movies of growing snowflakes. So let's try this one. Okay, so we start. We're going to start with a little tiny prism, which we drop onto a glass plate. Okay, and I always have to say this is not a computer simulation. This is a real snowflake. I've shown these before, and people come up to me after the talk. It's like, that was a great computer simulation. No computer simulation. This is the real McCoy. So we grow out the plate forms on top of the pedestal, and it starts to grow. And what you don't see here is me sitting in the background changing the knobs, because I have control of the temperature and the supersaturation, so I can make it do things. And so we watch it grow. Okay. Let's be done with that one. Let's see, how do we get out of here? There's one. I got a few more. Here's another one. Okay, start with a little plate. And so this one, you know, I adjusted the conditions so it was mostly plate-like growth for a while. And then I turn on higher supersaturation that makes the branches grow. Then I say, oh, let's have plates again. No, branches. I meant branches. I say, no, plates. I want plates. No, I want branches. It's a lot of fun. It takes about 45 minutes to do one of these. And so there's that. Let's see. Oh, it's a few more here. So here's one where I started with two seeds. I just happened to get two, so I went with it. And now you see they interfere with one another. So, you know, a lot of people think every snowflake's got to be perfectly hexagonal. No, that's only if they grow just right. If they interfere with anything at all, then they sort of don't get hexagonal. Okay. All right, we'll do this one too. What the heck? So this one I really went plate-like. Plate. Now, you know, sometimes I'll just change the temperature a little bit and it'll put these ribs on, because otherwise it's too boring. So, you know. And then I change it and make it grow plate-like. You know, in principle, you could make whatever you wanted. Someday we'll even be able to calculate what it is that's happening. And then make what you want. People always ask me, it's like, well, can you make two alike? You know, wouldn't that be new? I said, well, you know, it's hard enough just to make one alike. So, you know, you got to go get all this stuff set up. It's not so easy. I try to make it look easy, but, you know, then you got to sit around for 45 minutes watching it grow. I really like this one. This is a very majestic crystal in the end. I'm finding now I think I can actually make nicer crystals in the lab than I can find outside. So I'm going to probably quit taking snowflake pictures and just take snowflake pictures in the lab and make movies at the same time. Movie making business is wonderful. You know, a typical documentary might be $100,000 a minute. So there's some serious scratch going on here. So. Anyway, I'll stop at that. Questions?
A few days ago on Google, there was a kind of large snowflake remark all over the place. It's ridiculous. Do you have any feeling what the largest snowflake would or could be?
Well, you know, that's a funny story, too, because I can show you the world's largest snow crystal. I'll show it to you. I'm going to do it on my talk tonight, but I'll show it to you now. Hang on. See, what Google had... let's see if I can find it. I didn't show it today, but I'll show it tonight. What Google was talking about is there's a difference between a snow flake and a snow crystal. This is a big snow crystal. I got this one up in Cochrane, in northern Ontario. That's 1 centimeter from tip to tip. And that, I claim, is the largest snow crystal ever recorded, and certainly the last largest one ever photographed. It was fun. My microscope, even at the low resolution, my microscope sort of had this much. So I had to take 4 pictures and stitch them together. But Google was talking about this thing a long time ago, a 38-centimeter snowflake. And that's different. I mean, people, when they talk about snowflakes, they sometimes mean snow crystals. That's a single crystal. But a lot of times the crystals combine and form these puffballs, right? People call those snowflakes, too. And apparently, in 1885, it sounds like the story has been a little embellished over the years, but apparently in the 1880s, somebody saw some of these puffballs that are kind of pancake-shaped, but about this big. And could be true. They're easily a few centimeters. That's seen all the time. So it's possible. But it's not the same as a snow crystal. And the worst was the Google Doodle had an 8-sided snowflake. All wrong.
This no two snowflakes alike thing, of course, everybody hears about it when they're a kid. What do we really know about the morphology space of snowflakes? I mean, it's like one could say no two DNA strands are alike, but in fact, there's a finite number of configurations. It's very large, but it's not infinite.
Yeah.
So do we have any sense of how to quantify the morphology space?
You know, it's not hard. You could just talk about, so if you have a larger snowflake, a star shape, you know, the photogenic snowflakes, you can just count how many features there are. You know, individual little things, like on a fingerprint, you know, it's like there's a little ridge and there's a little thing and there's, and if you've got 100 features, you know, this has got many hundreds of features. If you even have 100 features, the number of the configuration space is, you know, of order 100 factorial. That's a big space.
But it's not infinite.
Well, it's bigger than the total number of atoms in the universe, so it's pretty big. You know, it's 10 to the 50 times bigger than the total number of snowflakes that have fallen on Earth.
But somewhere out in the multiverse.
Now, on the other hand, when we're making these crystals in the lab, I mean, we don't want stuff like this. This is too hard to analyze. What we like to make, or I like to make, are little tiny hexagons that are about 30 microns in diameter. And they all look like little hexagons. So now, of course, if you counted every molecule, they'd be different. But still, they all look the same. And of course, if you got to a small enough number of molecules, then they might be exactly, by quantum mechanical logic, they would be exactly the same. A 10-molecule snowflake could be exactly the same as some other 10-molecule snowflake. So it's a Zen-like question. It depends on what you mean by alike and what you mean by a snowflake. So.
I don't know the details, but I read an article probably half a year ago where there was a group that was actually offering a prize for anyone who could find 2 snowflakes that were the same.
I've never heard about that.
And as far as I'm aware, the prize was actually given. So I'll have to look up the article and send it to you. But
yeah, I'd love to hear it. You know, there was a funny story there because there's a meteorologist in Boulder. And, oh gosh, it must have been 25 years ago that they were looking at snowflakes, crystals up in the high atmosphere for some meteorological reason. And they collected 2 little hollow columns side by side that looked very similar. And probably it was just 2 parts of one crystal that broke apart when they collected it. But there they were. They're on one photographic film. There were these 2 little crystals that looked identical. And so So she put out a press release saying that she had discovered two snowflakes alike. And I think it's the worst thing she ever did. The press hounds her to this day about this press release because it's like, you know, it's just a silly question. I mean, you know, there's no two trees alike. There's no two people. There's no two grains of sand that are alike. But nobody seems to care about that. But snowflakes somehow. I can tell you why. You know, it's because when you look at a snowflake, not this, this is not a good example, but some of them are this beautiful symmetry. You know, we don't publish the ugly pictures. We only publish the beautiful. But they kind of look like they're manufactured. And when people manufacture things, you know, we have blueprints and factories, and everyone look, every car looks exactly the same. But in nature, things grow. Nothing is manufactured. Everything grows. So everything looks different. I mean, no two trees are the same, no two people. It seems like a very inefficient system. If I were making life, I would make everyone the same. But apparently that's not the best way to do it.
So as I understand it, rainbows arise by virtue of prism effect of sort of ice crystals in the upper atmosphere. And the best rainbows occur when you have certain kinds of crystals.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering if your work has sort of led to more detail on what the phase diagram looks like and maybe a bit more insight into what conditions would be ideal for rainbows, for example.
Well, rainbows are liquid drops, so it's a totally different game. But there are atmospheric halos, which is how light refracts through ice crystals. And there's a huge literature, actually, on atmospheric halos and the types of crystals that make the different types of halos. And some of the halos, especially from the South Pole, are these gorgeous, elaborate things. And it takes quite a bit of doing to explain all the features. Some of them have new other facets. Besides these six, there are other facets that form. They form what are called odd radius halos. And so people have been studying that for a long time. And their colors, sun dogs have colors. Those are all prismatic effects from small ice crystals, usually very high altitude, very cold. And the best place is like the South Pole, where you tend to get very pristine crystals. Once you get structure, then all that goes away.
In any given snowfall, do you see all of the range of things or just a particular type?
No, you know, when I'm out looking for snowflakes, every snowfall is different and they change a lot from time to time. So, you know, a typical thing is I'll be out, I'll be looking around and the snow just looks like garbage. It all looks like sand. And but maybe it's promising, so I'll set up my microscope and then I just wait and, you know, a couple hours goes by and then for half an hour you get these gorgeous crystals. And then it goes back to junk again. It's depends a lot on the details, and I don't understand it all. One of the things is, of course, the temperature has to be right, but another thing you really like is a very light snowfall so the crystals don't interfere. And especially good if the clouds are really low. So otherwise they're formed and they kind of melt a little, evaporate a little on the way down, but if they're growing right above you, then you get some really nice crystals. So yeah, every snowfall is different, and they change a lot from time to time. It's kind of entertaining to watch.
Okay, maybe Rafa.
So you showed the two snowflakes growing, stone crystals growing, and there was some evident interaction between the two. So does that mean that there's also some interaction between the neighboring arms of a single
crystal? Oh, absolutely.
Crystal? And if so, it must be something that, I mean, you could imagine there was some instability where the two arms would get different from each other.
Well, you
but
can
apparently
see,
it's yeah. more stable, tending towards making them the same, or is that?
You can
that
see it. I mean,
conclusion?
this thing's fairly planar, and the branches will collide with one another, and they do interfere with the growth. And so a lot of times the branches will grow, and they just sort of stop when they get close to one another. Now, with a big crystal like this, it's not exactly planar, so they can actually overlap a little. But they do interfere with one another, absolutely.
But I was just wondering if that. There's a potential there for an instability where one arm, I don't know, let's say one arm would get a little bigger and
oh.
some of the other.
Yeah,
why
you should come to my talk tonight. Because you'll see a lot of things like that. For example, if you get a capped column, some of the capped columns have very very small cap, very narrow, very very short prism, and then two plates growing on a very short prism. And those two plates are growing out, and they very much compete for the water vapor. And if one wins, then off it goes, and the other one's stunted. And so you'll often find a capped column where one plate is very small and the other plate's very big. So one brother, one over the other. And sometimes you'll see one where three branches on this side one, and three branches on the other plate one over here. And so it looks like an ordinary snowflake, but it's actually not. And I'll show you. I'll show you a very nice example of that. Here, let me. Here's one. So there's the little nub, that's the column, and then it starts two plates screwing that column. And you can see these three branches belong to one plate, and these three branches belong to the other plate. So that's the instability. And you can get 3 plus 3 or 1 plus 5 and anything you want. I mean, they're all out there. So it's just, you know, the two are going side by side, and one of them has to win. There's six little races going on.
I thought the point of the question was sort of this, that when you look at that big 1 centimeter, the one that you had, so symmetrical, it almost looks like one part of it was talking to the other part and saying, this is the way I'm going. Did you say something about that? Does that make any sense?
No, it doesn't.
Well, but you say, I know you're going to say that the script, the conditions are the same, and therefore it happens the same way. And yet, they can't really be the same on different sides.
Well, now you have to remember there's a selection effect. And that's me selecting the crystal. Because, you know, I like to sell snowflake books, and nobody wants pictures of ugly snowflakes. So I tend to choose the ones that are nice and symmetrical. But there's lots of crystals that are not symmetrical. And, you know, most of them are not symmetrical. That's really the norm. Let's see, where's an example here? You're not going to want to come to my talk tonight, I can tell. Let's see, where's a good one? Shoot. There we go, there they are. So there's one. There's one, there's an asymmetrical snowflake. There's one that's a little less, you know, they're talking, but you know, this is norm. This is most of what you find. I mean, this is normal. The really symmetrical ones are kind of abnormal. But no, if you really look at the physics, it makes perfect sense that it's just the conditions are the same on the six branches. That's all you need to explain it. You know, that's been the standard model for 100 years, and it remains the standard model to this day.
I mean, if we think of these as like sort of two-dimensional crystals, what's known as fractals? What's known unlike the Hausdorff dimension of the thing? Is that known? Like you know, how does the area of the crystal, if you think of it as 2D, how does the area scale as a function of the resolution you're measuring?
Yeah,
is that known?
Yeah. There's some self-similar aspects of snow crystals, and I never gave it a lot of thought because they're not very self-similar. There's just a little bit, and that's just the fractal nature of the diffusion-limited growth. I mean, if you grow these things big enough, then the branches get side branches, and the side branches get side branches. But, you know, it's kind of not the most interesting physics, so I haven't spent a lot of time looking at it. Mostly, they're just not big enough. You know, there's not a lot of self-similarity in these things.
As you're growing these in a lab, like what limits your size? At what point do you have to stop, or does it not do anything?
You know, it's pretty much all experimental. I mean, if we wanted to grow really large crystals, it's just building a different apparatus, I think.
So just the size of your apparatus? They don't fit?
You know, the new machine I'm building is going to have a 1 centimeter hole where the light comes in, and that's will be the limit to the size of the crystal. But
do you anticipate any limit?
You know, at some point they fall apart because they're only so strong. And the crystal, oddly enough, when you look at a point like this, it doesn't fracture like a crystal fractures. It actually just you get lots of dislocations, and a branch will be growing, and it just sort of goes, it just droops down. Because, you know, it put enough pressure on this point, it kind of melts, and it's full of dislocations, and it just... So if you make them big enough, they just fall apart. In the atmosphere, it's worse because you got wind blowing them around and they collide with things. But even in the lab, once you get, you know, beyond that size, they start to be pretty fragile. But yeah, again, there's no real reason to want to do that. So I haven't thought about it too much. Maybe in space, you know.
You seem to have been quite successful at funding your research, but there is there is some group that I would imagine would be interested in the physics of snowflake growth, which is people who manufacture snow for ski areas. And have you ever looked at the snow that they make Because I always find that it just, you know, becomes ice when it hits the ground, but what are the flakes like?
Yeah, you know, they don't make flakes. The way artificial snow is made is you've got water, which you send through an atomizer to make little droplets. And those droplets are mixed with compressed air. And when the compressed air expands, it gets cold. And then when it gets cold, the droplets freeze. And so you get basically sleet. Those are frozen drops. And if you look at them under the microscope, they look like frozen drops. And you want to get them to freeze while they're undergoing this expansion. If it's too warm, they might not freeze. And then they hit the ground as water. And then you just make a pile of ice. That's terrible. So you have to put in enough compressed air that the droplets will freeze. But really, it's just a liquid to solid phase transition. There's no structure, really. Here's an interesting tidbit, though. And you can always add enough compressed air to make what's coming out of the nozzle cold enough to make snow. You know, you can even make it in Pasadena. People sometimes do. You know, there are companies you can buy. They use liquid nitrogen. But you can make snow. But it's expensive. The compressed air gives a big electric bill. And so the ski resorts don't like that. So what you want is you want droplets that freeze right away. Pure water freezes at minus 38, something like that. So you got to have impurities in the droplet to nucleate the freezing from liquid to water, from liquid to ice. And so, you know, normal water, if you just take it out of the tap or out of the lake, it's usually where they get it at a ski resort, it'll freeze around minus 10. But you can buy this bacteria. It's an ice nucleating bacteria that actually raises the freezing point from around minus 10 to maybe minus 2 or 3. And it's a natural bacteria, so you don't mind spreading it all over the environment because it's already all over the environment. And so people mix this stuff in. It's called Snowmax. They mix it into the water, and then they can lower the electric bill by not having so much compressed air. So it's a little bit of ice nucleating biology that actually helps the ski resort. I didn't think of any of that. That's been around a long time. So there's a whole field of biological nucleation, too.
Is there any way to preserve them?
You know, you can do that. One easy way, which doesn't work very well, but it's still easy, and it does work sometimes, is you take a snowflake and it falls onto a glass slide, and you put a glob of super glue on top. And the super glue will just fill in all the spaces. And then you got to let the super glue dry while it's still cold, which might take a week. It doesn't dry very fast and it's cold. So you just take that thing and you set it aside for at least a few days or a week. And then you've got a little replica of the snowflake.
It doesn't melt when you add that super glue?
No, that's got to be cold. You got the super glue is outside with you.
Okay.
So everything's at 10, 15 below. And then you drop it on there. And it does work. You can make replicas. I have a few. They're not especially pretty, but they're kind of fun. You know, you can hold them in your hand. It's like, here's my snowflake.
Okay, well, before we kind of close the walls, let me just remind you that there should be some snacks downstairs in the bistro area. So let's thank Kenneth.